Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast, the X-Men 97 years. My name is Willie Simpson.
And I'm Brian Fusco.
Brian, you're not Sonya Rappaport. But we are thrilled to have you here. Brian, you are a longtime member of our fan community, a dear friend to the show. And we are so happy you can come in and fill in for Sonya, who's abroad this week. So thank you so much for being here, Brian.
It's really my pleasure. Thanks again. It's great. I'm excited to do it.
No problem, Brian. Brian, this week we are doing Life, Death, Part 2, which I believe is the sixth episode overall of the first season of X-Men 97, or technically the sixth season of X-Men Task. Where do you fall on that right away? Let's get right into it. Is this the sixth season, or is this the first season of a new show?
I mean, you know, it's got a different title technically, but obviously it's not a reboot or a restart of the lore and the team, the storylines. So I think it's literally both. I think it's literally okay to call it both.
I think it would have been cool if Disney just did put it all on the same show page. Yeah. I think they realized that would have been too confusing, but I don't know. Yeah. I wonder how much this show is inspiring people to go back and watch the original. Cause I think they've clearly gotten a whole bunch, like a whole new audience here. All right. I'm already wildly, on a wild tangent here. Let me dispense with the plugs. You can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky Threads, at Willie Simpson. Join the X-Men Task Podcast, Facebook, or Reddit groups where you can interact with us and the rest of the audience. You can leave us a nice 5-star review on iTunes. We appreciate everyone who does just that. And last but not least, in our goal to make the show server cost neutral, you could donate to our Buy Me a Coffee page. There's information in the show links on your podcast. Brian, I don't even know where to start with this episode. Again, every week, I don't know about you, I'm finding myself overwhelmed with this show. And so with that in mind, actually, yeah. I do want to put a pin before we talk about it. And I'm going to ask you the same question, but, you know, normally in this part of the show, we talk about what we've been watching. I did binge with Sonya absent. I watched every episode of Fallout, the new Amazon Prime TV show. Are you a Fallout fan? Did you see the show? Do you have any takes on it?
I'm not familiar with it, though. I did see, I think, something about Kyle MacLachlan is in the show, and I'm a yes. big Twin Peaks fan, so that's always a credit to any show he joins, so I'd be interested in checking it out.
So you're not a Fallout gamer? You didn't check out any of the
RPGs? No, I don't have any.
Okay, sorry. Fair enough. All right, no, I totally sprung this on you. I just want to say I watched every episode of Fallout. I think it was awesome. I was a Fallout gamer. I played Fallout 3 most memorably, but I also played New Vegas. And Fallout 4. I didn't play the original first two. Anyway, I'm not going to get in. We'll talk more about Fallout in the future when Sonya gets back, because I'm going to probably force her to watch the show, whether she likes it or not. I just wanted to say that I did love the show. Full recommend. That was awesome. Back to X-Men here. This was another crazy episode. It's kind of like, a lot happens in this episode, but it did feel like a resetting the stakes a bit kind of episode, right?
Yes, definitely.
It's like we're catching up with, we're finishing the Storm storyline here, and we're catching up with Professor X in outer space, and they're giving you, it feels like they're setting up like a few of the last chess pieces before they have their epic blowout final three episodes. Although I guess we'll have like another one episode next week in episode 7.
Right.
But this was a marking time episode. But despite that, I'd say it was a total blast and pretty awesome. I don't know. What was your reaction to it? What's your general take on this episode?
Well, I really enjoyed it. I mean, having the chance to watch it twice today, the second time through, it actually kind of felt a little thinner in certain ways. Like plot wise, there's not really all that much that happens. But the writing, the voice acting, the animation, and just sort of the overall thrust of it was still so enjoyable. And again, like you can have an episode where not a whole lot plot-wise happens, but certain key moments can make the whole thing an unforgettable episode that is so worth it, regardless of how much did or didn't actually occur.
I agree. I would say this episode had many key moments that are borderline iconic. I mean, no, they are iconic, especially if you're an X-Men fan. Yeah. I thought it was great. I was pretty dazzled by this episode, but I'm fully in line with what you just said. It's not like last week, which was like a complete like movie-esque drama of enormous stakes. This was just more of like sort of catching up with some characters and figuring out how they're going to play into the story going forward. With that all said, let's like jump right into the intro. So Gambit and Magneto have been excised from the credits, which again, I'm impressed with the way they just keep changing these credits around to make them different and interesting every week. That's pretty fun.
I love it. It's so great. As soon as we watched episode 2 on the very first day that they released those, you know, first two episodes, and we saw that they were different, I was like, they're going to do this with every episode. And I am big time here for it. It's so fun.
And I did notice some little stuff before we talk about the huge stuff in the credits, but like Gambit is still in the credits, sort of. He's like in the X-Jet at the beginning. Yep. He's at the end when they're all running together, collide at the football game. So he's not like removed. And same thing with Magneto. Magneto's at the end too, but their title cards are gone. If it was up to me, I would never remove a title card, no matter what the status of the character's life is. I would just have it like I'd have the opening credits run like 3 minutes if it had to.
Right. Just keep building and expanding. Yeah. Well, the one note on the title cards that I thought was interesting, especially because, not to steal the thunder on this particular reveal, but yeah, and with Nightcrawler finally getting a title card, what was interesting to me is he doesn't appear in the episode. Yeah. And so I thought to myself, I was like, when I saw that, I'm like, oh, and we're going to probably have a tag at the end of the episode, even though it's mostly about Xavier in space and Storm and Forge. We're going to probably have a little tag where we're seeing the briefly, maybe the aftermath of episode 5 and Nightcrawler going back to the mansion with Rogue or something like that.
Yeah.
But they didn't. And so I realized finally that the title cards are not who's in the episode or who's featured. It's just who's on the team now and who's not on the team now. You know what I mean? So Gambit and Magneto are presumed dead or are actually dead, whatever. They're not on the team now. Nightcrawler is, we can assume, on the team now, even though he didn't show up. And Bishop, you know, is not on the team anymore, but he was first couple episodes. So that was really interesting that that's the true key there is like, are you on the team or not on the team as of that episode? Right?
And the Nightcrawler title card was awesome too. Yeah, that was a flurry of beautiful animation. Like I said last week, Nightcrawler is such a great cartoon character.
Yep.
He just looks great. And they have him just like fully, you know, this is why I love the X-Men animated series, the original, is because they tried to stay as true as they could to whatever comic book versions they were doing. Whereas like, you know, like a lot of, you know, X-Men cartoons too, like X-Men Evolution or Wolverine the X-Men or in other adaptations of like when they try to update superhero characters, they want to put a new spin on them, give them a new costume.
Yeah.
Like, give them a new like edgier attitude. And I'm not like against that, but I love how, for instance, here just with Nightcrawler, he's just the classic Nightcrawler from the comics and it's enough. You know, he looks, the classic costume looks great. He's got the swords, he's bamfing around. There's no need to like give him any extra kind of like edge or like difference just yet. Like maybe in time if they evolve him as a character, but he's fine as a fully formed, perfect, iconic cartoon character.
100%. And I have to say, like, that was one of, once they, you know, first announced X-Men 97 and then later they showed like some little preview images. I'm talking like still 2 years ago and Nightcrawler was in them. I was like, great, because the difference for me in my X-Men fandom character-wise from when I was a kid during the original run versus now is that I had the time in between to really go back and read the whole Claremont run. And because, you know, as a kid, X-Men Animated Series was my first introduction really to the team, knowing the characters, and Nightcrawler wasn't part of it. Because during those years, he was on Excalibur in the comics, and he was just a guest star in a couple episodes.
Yep.
And as I got to know him through reading the backlog, so to speak, in the years since, I love him so much. And then I, thinking back about the original series, you're right. They had him mostly right. But my problem with him in the original series is that he's just so dour, serious. So pious. Yeah. And exactly. It was a little bit, I think they erred a little too much on that side. And sure, he was a great contrast to the other characters, and I can understand maybe why they did it that way. But the one big hope for Nightcrawler I had, aside from him maybe joining the team, which now I think is the case, for this new show is, are they going to get him really right? And last week settled it, because he still had very, again, you could say pious, right? Like, he still had words of wisdom to Gambit when they were on Genosha and he was talking to him about Rogue and stuff. That was very much in keeping with Nightcrawler's more thoughtful side. But he also was having fun.
He was goofy,
bamfing around, and like, just like you said, like the true cartoon character aspect of him. And that's what was needed. I'm so excited to have him be on the show more now, as then that they really have got him right.
Me too. We just need to see him drink a beer with Wolverine. Then I'll be pleased. And then
yes.
So all right, more stuff in the opening credits real quick. We see there's a new scene of Master Mold. He's like building Nimrod, which looks kind of badass. And then we get like another, like we see Bishop, Storm and Wolverine in the Age of the Apocalypse flashback episodes fighting Nimrod.
Right.
So those are like our weird little like contextual clue teasers. I feel like there's reasons they include these like new little scenes from X-Men history.
I was only going to say, just because of course after last week there was so much scuttlebutt about who sent the Sentinel to Genosha.
Yeah.
And there was the Easter egg from 2 weeks ago, the first part of Life Death, with the photo on Forge's wall that shows Dr. Adler, Forge, and then mostly covered Bastion, who was not a character I was ever into, like back when he was in the comics, I guess. But what I do know, if I know anything about him, Bastion is a post Siege Perilous combination of Master Mold and Nimrod. That's what Bastion literally is. So when, after all the talk online last week about Bastion maybe being behind the Sentinel going to Genosha, and then the intro shows literally Nimrod inside of Master Mold, I was like, well, that's that. But then at the end of the episode, that wasn't that. We'll get to that later. But there still could be a Bastion element, I guess. But the end of the episode threw me for a loop after what they showed in the intro. I was like, it's got to be Bastion.
That's another great thing about the show is like they have been like giving out false clues.
Yes.
And Mr. X and stuff like they're and they've also like had so many. They've like introduced like different cameos and different ideas where they're saying like anything is on the table, which is a lot of fun. They're really keeping you on your toes as like an audience member. So we could get like a Bastion thing. I mean, like Apocalypse keeps appearing in the opening credits too. Like, what's his role in all this? I don't know. All right, let's just jump into this episode. There's way too much talk. Oh, I have to mention before we're still technically in the beginning of the podcast. Big shout out to Ben who donated to our Buy Me a Coffee website. Thank you so much, Ben. We really appreciate it. You're another one of our great longtime community members. We love you and thank you so much for donating to the show. I'd be completely remiss if I had forgotten that. Okay. The episode opens. Jesus, my notes. There's another shot of the X-Men fighting the Shi'ar Empire, the Imperial Guard on the moon during the Phoenix Saga. And Professor X with like Landra, they're showing like their love connection too in the opening credits. All right. Now the episode opens with the Shi'ar Empire. There's a battle in space, and it turns out it's the Shi'ar versus the Kree.
Right.
And
it's Ronan the Accuser, who we know from Guardians of the Galaxy.
That's right. The Great Lee Pace.
Right.
I am doing a Halt and Catch Fire rewatch right now. Is a truly fantastic show. Lee Pace is the star.
Used to get to see, I know he was great on that show. And I used to see him when he was at Juilliard in training because a good friend of mine from high school was in his same class at Juilliard.
Whoa.
So back 25 years ago, he was amazing in a play. I forget the name of it, but it has like this imaginary language called Patitopy, and he was the teacher. So he had these interstitial scenes where he was this exhausted, frustrated teacher trying to teach students this new, like, made up language, and he's like, was really irritated with them. And so he's excellent.
I mean, he's obviously, I don't think he's doing the voice here unless.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think it got Lee Pace. It's like very small Ronan the Accuser version.
Yeah, but it was still cool to see the character.
This is what I love about the X-Men, and what disappointed me about the MCU in a general sense is that the X-Men space shit is so much more interesting to me than. Like, I know, like, they've done the Kree in the MCU, but the Kree, first of all, is not as interesting as the Shi'ar, and seeing the Shi'ar kick the Kree's ass is just like way more engaging to me and like fascinating. Yeah. And the whole world of the Shi'ar is interesting. I'm happy that we're back with the Shi'ar is my point. I'm like happy to see these guys again. So the scene like sort of unfolds where Deathbird is leading the attack on the Kree, and Ronan has a funny line where he says, "This pigeon shall not thwart the will of the supreme intelligence." So you get you're already getting a sense of like the interspecies racism between these cultures.
Yeah, I love it.
And I also I'm like sort of like thrown for a loop. I'm like, who am I supposed to be rooting for here? Because Deathbird is definitely traditionally a bad guy.
Right. Like, I thought she was going rogue, yes. You know, which she's done so many times in the comics, but no, that's legit from Lalandra, isn't it?
She's been ordered. She's like on Lalandra's side and working with her to help conquer the Kree, which sounds kind of evil, which I guess gets discussed a bit later. You know, she's fighting Ronin. The Imperial Guard shows up. Our old pal Gladiator is there. Everyone's talking about one of the new Imperial Guard members is Vulcan, which is one of the lost Summers brothers. But that was a retcon I was like never too thrilled with personally. I don't know. How do you feel about the whole Vulcan character?
Yeah, I haven't read that whole run of him and the whole, like, I guess, Rise and Fall of the Shi'ar Empire, I think the storyline is called. I mean, stuff between like the late 90s and... now I've only read certain things that I've heard were like really great, like Messiah Complex and a few things like that, and some of the Krakoa stuff. But basically, I haven't read that. I wasn't a huge fan of there being yet another Summers brother. Yeah. It was pretty also hard to believe, but I guess it's comics, you know, magic and sci-fi that, like, because the mom, I think it's what Cyclops' mom was pregnant with him, even when Deken murdered her.
Yeah, but she took saved the baby the fetus. Out or whatever. Yeah, they raised it in prison, and then they advanced his age magically to make him an adult from a baby. That's a bunch of bullshit to me. I don't care about Vulcan. I'm sure he has fans out there, and I'm sure that like if they do like some Explorer episodes with him and they make it cool, I bet I get on board with it. But I'm with you in terms of like the comic continuity that we know. It's in that category of like they messed with something that they made something. A simple story, a little more complicated than they needed to. The same way that when you find out that Thomas Wayne was alive, you know, this whole time. And, you know, it's like, why? There doesn't need to be another Summers brother, but okay, whatever. He's there. It made people happy to see him. The Kree are defeated pretty easily. I didn't realize how powerful Lady Bird was, where she like sticks her heel into Ronan's face.
Yeah.
That was hardcore, brutal, and she's like very super powered. I didn't know that was an aspect of her character to be that strong. And then we cut to Lalandra and Professor X. Professor X, voiced by now Ross Marquand, who I think does a pretty good job, like living up to what was his name? Is the names of the original voice actors? I think Cedric Smith, maybe. I think he does a pretty good job like summoning his voice.
Yeah, I thought it was you know, a serviceable impression, certainly, and it gets the job done. It wasn't too jarring or anything. It's funny because that actor I think was on The Walking Dead.
Yeah,
like that was the first time I had seen him. I didn't watch the whole series, but like it dropped out.
He's in a bunch of stuff.
But I remember him.
But I mean, like this version of the professor's voice, it's somewhere between like Irish and Mid-Atlantic and like Canadian.
Right. They're not going full British, which they've done in some TV series. But
I actually like the original Professor X voice, I think, nailed it in a lot of it's like a commanding voice that is vaguely British or Irish or something, but not quite. And I think when that happens, the answer is Canadian. But
yes, exactly.
But it was a good voice. So Ross Marquand stepping in, he's doing a good job. So, you know, the Shi'ar are at war with the Kree, and in the midst of this like major like galactic event, Lalandra decides to make a universal like a statement to her and people saying she's getting married, she's in love with Professor X, and that he's going to be your new emperor. Everybody, like meet your new dad.
That was something. And can I say I noticed something in the crowd during the announcement scene? There is one female Dabari alien, and the Dabari, of course, are the ones that are sometimes called derogatively the broccoli people or asparagus people. I've heard both, but that's the planet that Dark Phoenix destroyed when she ate their son.
Oh shit!
So there's one shot of like a Dabari person. It's not a close up; they're like in a whole, you know, crowd, but you can see a Dabari because they have the very distinctive face. And I was like, oh, okay. There's one Dabari who's okay.
Justice
I guess
for
in the
Dabari.
Original series, in the original, I guess Dark Phoenix in the 90s, she actually they're like, oh, that planet was uninhabited.
Yeah, that's luckily the planet was uninhabited.
Yeah, that's lucky. So, but anyway,
if they were redoing the Phoenix Saga in X-Men 97, the planet would have been inhabited.
Oh yeah,
no question. This show is a lot more violent and messed up. So Professor X makes his grand entrance. He's back on the show. He has his like gold and purple like exoskeleton suit that allows him to walk. It's like kind of true to the comics. Like I think the suit looked a little different from my memories of the comic books, but it's close.
What's interesting is that the suit that he's wearing, as I recall, is exactly what he was wearing in the like Shi'ar versus Skrull story from the Uncanny X-Men, like 270s right after Extinction Agenda or whatever. And at that point, he could walk for real. So it actually wasn't like it is on the show here where it's helping him walk. Later on, like in Fatal Attraction,
like a battle suit.
He had an exoskeleton one. That was the one where in the episode, where Magneto
that's what Wolverine's
like adamantium. Purple. So there are two different, it's like they combine two different suits on the show.
You know, now that you mention that,
so he can't walk on the
show. They're going to do that storyline.
Oh yeah, he can walk.
Well, this show has been insanely Wolverine light up to this point. They're going to do the Magneto ripping out the Wolverine skeleton, I bet, in like season two or something. I just have a feeling that they're saving
it. I believe it. Yeah. I believe that for sure.
That's my big like first prediction for the future of X-Men. I haven't done too much speculating yet personally, but now like I have a feeling like shit like that's going to happen. All right. All right. So now, Lady Bird and Lady Bird. Deathbird. I actually, in my notes, I have her written down as Lady Bird, which is a huge sign of mental decline. Deathbird is like smirking. Like you could tell that like she's going to use this, that she realizes this is a mistake that Lalandra's making. Like just the bringing Professor X as like a leader of this galactic empire. Cut to Professor X and Lalandra. They're in some kind of like Avatar-esque galactic garden, and they're, I don't know what they're doing. They're planting space seeds, walking around with strange plant animals. And Charles, you could tell that he's a bit unsure about this new role where he went from being, Professor X, this sort of like mutant leader on Earth, to now like his life is going to be, I'm going to be like co-emperor of some strange, galactic civilization. And you could tell he has doubts about it.
Well, it's funny because he gets a throne next to her later, but at the same time, they are referring to him as the royal consort, which is basically like, the person that the Empress is married to, but not the Emperor. I mean?
He's not.
So unless I was misreading it, he's not actually going to be in charge of anything, although he may have some say.
He's going to have influence. I think what the people are afraid of.
Right. His influence will only go so far, though, as he can persuade Lalandra to do things, because otherwise. Right. But it was pretty hilarious in the garden scene where he's like, you could rule the Shi'ar Empire from Earth. Yeah. it was quite a reach. I guess he could say I had to try, but
Professor, he comes off as kind of goofy in this episode. And they're definitely adapting from the comics here. This is not like, they're not taking a wild swing. Like this is stuff Professor X dealt with in the comics.
Oh yeah.
But, and it had to end too in the comics. Like this was not going to be his destiny. So, but it is funny here, like, seeing him like toy with the idea of actually committing to this new life. And you could tell like almost immediately that this is not going to work out. And Lalandra has some like pretty funny, like true X-Men dialogue. And I mean, like in this sort of like epic Shakespearean dialogue about, she could tell he misses his family. And she says, families often mimic black holes, visit just being stuck in its ever spiraling vacuum of dramas. That is like the X-Men 97 is just filled with filled with so many more of these like poetic type of dialogue moments between characters that you'd get a lot in the original series, but like mainly saved for like Apocalypse or Magneto, get them constantly.
Right. But it's very Chris Claremont, to
the T. Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're right. It is Chris Claremont. Yeah. I keep thinking like in my mind, I always just just think about Apocalypse from the original series, but like that's also really it is all from like Chris Claremont's verbose.
Right. It comes from that tradition, even though other later writers like took it, like carried it forward. I think it wouldn't have been that way if he hadn't like laid it out in the first place and they just sort of follow along. But oh God, yeah, I really do hope, just a quick aside, that Apocalypse will show his face at one point, maybe not this season, but in X-Men 97 in one of the future seasons, because just need more of his speechifying.
Love I know. I'm sure they'll knock it out of the park with like whatever weird speeches they give him. Yeah. Lalandra is like, she's trying to like do her best in making Charles like try to compromise with him. Although I think her compromises are kind of weak. She's like, oh, we can invite the X-Men to the wedding.
Yeah.
You know, right. Like that. Why not that? It's like, okay, I see my friends for a day. All right. And, but it is like, I mean, it's just, it is weird. It's like, she is in charge of this strange, like, imperial system that is violence rooted.
Yeah.
And it does seem like very much against like anything Professor X would want to be a part of. Because she's like talking about she's very invested in this war with the Kree and conquering them. That seems pretty fucked up to me. I know right. The Kree aren't like exactly good guys, but still it's like, I don't know.
Well, you know, she's like, she literally uses the phrase, like that was the moment for me where I like really perked up, because she was like, once we crushed the Kree. And like,
yeah.
I don't even think she talked like that in the comics, like in the old school, like 70s and 80s comics, like that was really harsh. But again, like that's kind of the point of like, that's how empires are built. And Professor X, not to get ahead of it, really gets into that in his little, in his lesson to the Shi'ar later. So,
and like you alluded to earlier too, he's like, oh, like, you know, he's like, we could rule from Earth, you know? And she's like, I'll consider it. But you could tell she has like no interest. That is not a non-starter for them. And she also is like, listen, like, dude, you taught them, like, they need to learn how to walk on their own, which I think is like kind of a valid point from her standpoint, that like the X-Men will be fine without you. But
it's a very valid point, and honestly, just I'm just gonna lay it down here, I kind of wish he would stay, because I just have to say I'm really not that I don't like him as a character necessarily, but like, but I think I really was have been digging the X-Men without him. Like they got to stand on their own feet, and like he's taught them, I mean, maybe he has more to teach them, but I feel like, you know, I kind of enjoyed a Professor X free X-Men at this point. But hey, you never I mean know.
His character traditionally does exist to like be pushed out of the narrative a lot of the times anyway, because
he's too powerful, as we'll see later. It's like,
yeah,
he just, I love the line where he's like, I have forgotten my I have you know, forgotten my greatest gift. It's like, yeah, no shit you did. Why how did you let it get this far? But anyway, yeah, it's something where they got to nerf him normally, because he could just end every conflict if he wanted to.
Yeah,
so it's interesting. I mean,
and in the original show, they're so creative with it. With like all of season two, he's just lost in the Savage Land. Like that's great.
Yeah.
But it, again, Lalander and Professor X famously have a bond deeper than love. The bond is being tested quite extensively here. It makes you really question how deep this bond really is. It just seems like a normal, regular love, which is subject to all sorts of compromises and you know, doubts and insecurities. And now, so this episode, it's like a bifurcated episode. You jump between Lalandra in outer space and Forge back in the desert. And so now here we are, we're back at Forge's house. The scene setup is a little strange from where we left them the last time we saw them, where like now they're just all hanging out in a room together. The adversary Storm and Forge, like Storm, Forge is like gravely wounded. And Storm is just sort of taking care of him. With now the adversary is just chilling, like not attacking either of them. I thought that was a little baffling, but cool.
Right. Like I rewatched the second half I rewatched the Life Death Part One segment from the Jubilee Mojo Life Death episode from a couple of weeks ago first, to just make sure I wasn't missing anything, you know, like to be totally refreshed on that. And yeah, the adversary has Storm in its clutches at the very last moment. And then you cut to them just like, oh no, we're just doing our thing.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened between that moment and the first moment.
Well, it's like the character, episode, the character goes from being like a physical force with weird magic powers to now he's more of like a mental nightmare character,
right,
that exists in their minds. It's like a weird mixture. And I enjoy the license they're taking anyway. Like narratively, it's nice. Like I'm not trying to like say this is bad. But I do think that was like an interesting like resetting of the stakes of like what all these characters are hanging out together. So like so mainly like this character now exists to essentially taunt Storm mentally versus attacking it with its magic powers and beak with poison that is killing Forge. So he's taking a different tact with Storm than he did with Forge.
What I thought was really curious about the adversary in this episode, and I think, I was never a huge fan of the adversary in the like the comics version.
I mean, I barely remember him. Yeah,
the Uncanny X-Men part of Fall of the Mutants is focused on that, whereas the X-Factor part of Fall of Mutants is the whole Archangel creation. That's the part that's, you know, way better in my opinion of crossover, so to speak.
Yeah.
So the adversary was kind of like whatever to me, but it seemed to me in this episode that they kind of combined the adversary with another like one shot character from a one-shot issue, Uncanny X-Men 144, which is where you pick up with Cyclops right after Dark Phoenix Saga, like the next time you see Cyclops, because he's a team right after all. There's this one-shot that one-shot issue where this demon Despair is there.
It's like walking and it's in a graveyard or something. Yeah.
Right, right. And like this demon called Despair is there trying to tempt Cyclops. Like, and Lee, whatever, his sort of short-term blonde girlfriend that happens around that time.
Yeah.
But yeah, he like tries to tempt Cyclops to like give up on life. Like the whole thing is about like this demon that feeds on Despair and self-loathing, which is exactly what the adversary character in this episode keeps sort of alluding to and talking about. So I felt like it was, because it didn't, like what it actually does in this episode is not especially much like the adversary did in the comics, but it is a lot more like what Despair did in that Cyclops issue. So it was interesting to me. They kind of, I think, combined maybe these two different demons to make something, you know, a little bigger than
100%. That's a great connection you made. And you just bringing up Claremont earlier, it's just really like unlocking the show for me in a way that I hadn't considered in talking about it the past few weeks. Like, they are being really respectful to like Claremont's comics, and like so much of like this is why the show works so well, is because they're just adapting like elements and like storytelling tropes like directly from the Claremont comics that work so well, that makes those comics so like classic and readable to this day. And like that's why you could pick up like a little character like the adversary, and just it's like endlessly fascinating, like characters that like they just exist essentially to push our heroes to their like, you know, psychological or physical limits. Yeah. And they're often tests for the characters to overcome in like the most extreme circumstances. And so like you're saying, like adversary, Despair, they're all just like these great little like Claremont throwaway ideas that, you know, they serve two purposes where they hint at something larger, but at the same time, you know, they kind of just exist as like temporary challenges. And like that's like truly like the part of like the magic formula for what makes X-Men great. And this show really gets that. So, you know, now like the adversary is like more attacking Storm mentally. She's on some like psychedelic nightmare trip with him, she, like locks her in some kind of coffin, and she's fighting, you know, she's got claustrophobia. She's fighting. It's like, I do not fear death. And then the adversary is like, but you fear living, which I thought was that's like a nice little exchange of dialogue.
Right.
And then out of nowhere, Forge like has a magic book and attacks the adversary with like Doctor Strange-esque magic.
Exactly.
To his mother.
Yeah, yeah, he does have sorcery abilities in the comics, I know too, and he, even though he doesn't use them all that much, but yeah, I definitely noted how it's very clearly the MCU style of Doctor Strange kind of sorcery.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that Forge had magic too. That's something that I totally forgotten over the years. I mean, I fucking love Forge. I know he's not everyone's favorite. I don't know why. I've like actually read commentary that people think Forge is boring, but I think he's just like such a cool, great character, and I especially love the way he's been utilized in the X-Men animated series overall. He's like introduced in the future, and then they even like bothered to like show him in the present with X-Factor in the original series too.
Yeah,
and now here he is, like this is like full Claremont stuff, this version of Forge. I don't know, I just think I'm like excited to see Forge. Like, he's a live action character that I would be excited to see.
Oh yeah he doesn't take much CGI, I guess, for the leg and the hand maybe, but it doesn't take much CGI to do him, so
I mean,
Forge
is like a totally like side background character in many respects, right? Like, he exists like in the X-Men, he exists in X-Factor, like he's like not really a main guy, but his story alone to me could just be a movie. A Vietnam vet, like a Native American guy that's got like this incredible genius power, a power of being a genius. Like, to me, that is just like, I'd go see the Forge movie by itself, and he's not even like... He's not even like the 12th most important character in any X-Men story. You know what I mean?
No, exactly. But that's the great thing about, I mean, I really do hope that, sure, the MCU, as they get more with X-Men, like they can still have their non-X-Men character movies and do whatever they want, fine. But I really do, my hope is that the X-Men will just sort of supersede for the most part and just eventually take over, and we'll have all the like, could have all the spinoffs of the different side characters and teams. Like, it's there. It's all of it's better than all Avengers stuff.
Me too. X-Men is just so central to me enjoying Marvel as like a focal point. Like, I want to understand the Marvel universe through the perspective of the X-Men. Like, I care about the Avengers in as far as so much as like how it like relates to the X-Men. Like,
yes.
I enjoy Captain America, which, you know, he was teased in some video in the past week, but he's not in this one. But it's like, I enjoy Captain America as much as like when he crossed paths with the X-Men, you know what I mean? And there's other characters that sort of like, I do enjoy them as being the center of attention, like Spider-Man, like Fantastic Four. Yeah. But I'm in an X-Men world. Like, I want it all filtered through Jubilee watching television and like trying to understand like what's going on out there. Yeah. And anyway, so moving on here, Forge lets Storm know we're starting our little quest here. He says, do you need to find some kind of cactus that only grows underground in deep caves? That's the only way it can be healed. And of course it's a challenge for Storm because it means they have to like go like into dark caverns. That's very tough for her.
Yeah. And, tight space, tight tunnel.
Right. And it, here too, we get the sense that like Storm has totally forgiven Forge from her problems with him in the previous episode. She calls him her love. So
yeah, that was a little, it seemed a little quick, but that's fine. They're trying to work quick with this story, I think. So
I mean, the quick pace of everything works in the show's favor, in my opinion. You know, like we've mentioned, like one of my biggest problems with the MCU is like the endless dripping of teasing of every story element, no matter what it is. It's I'm trying to even think of it. Like, let's say like Black Widow and the Hulk falling in love, for instance, which they don't even consummate ever really. But it's like they tease it like over a couple of movies and then like a few movies later, they allude to it like having not worked out versus like. We don't just see them together and like being in the middle of something. You know what I mean? It's all this like bullshit of like, and here the show's just like giving you like everything. You just got to move along with it. And that's more exciting than just like scraps of like promises of story, like actually giving you the story. Did you know Lalander's last name was Namari? No, Naramani.
I did. I remember that, but I forgot.
Yeah. That's my segue to the next. So now we're back in outer space. You know, they're doing some like weird, like jingo, like, I don't know, like propagandistic appearance together as a couple in front of the Shi'ar Empire. Xavier says like, oh, I feel like your pet, but I don't hate the idea, which I thought was a little weird.
Yeah, that was very adult, but good for them.
Yeah.
She says, you can bark later.
The horniness level of this show is like by a factor of X10 compared to anything we've seen before with the X-Men, and that includes the fucking movies too, which is like the extent of which this show is just running laps around any X-Men movie that's ever been made is kind of embarrassing for the movies in a way too. Like, they had the X-Men world is just the level of like drama and soap operaness and like romance, it's just so much of it was just ignored. Like, just think about like the Dark Phoenix, which they attempted to do twice in the movies, of how they both times they made the decision to excise anything with the Shi'ar. But the Shi'ar shit is like so fun and like crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and of course, aside from that, too, like you can't do Dark Phoenix without doing Phoenix and without building it up. Like the idea that they think they can just, in both times, they could just like, well, let's just jump into Dark Phoenix. It's like,
in one
totally
movie,
ruined it. And in the most obvious, like it's so obvious it was going to not work. And I hope Simon Kinberg never is allowed anywhere near anything X-Men related for the rest of his life.
I know.
He ruined it twice. And when they announced the second time, he was like, we're going to get it right this time. It's like, no, you didn't even come close.
No.
How could you not come close?
I don't. Well, they like vaguely introduced the idea of aliens, but in the most stupidest way, it had nothing to do with the comics and
it was no good.
Poorly executed. I mean, anyway. Do you even think we're ever going to see you think it's just dead forever? The Phoenix story? Like
I think it's certainly possible they could try it in the early to mid 2030s. You know what I mean? Like if they decide, and if things are going strong still for the MCU with the X-Men as the central focus of it, of course, with still maybe Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, and smattering of Avengers things around the edges, then I could see them trying it again if they do it for real. But of course, as I think so many people have noted, for X-Men, there's still you can make great movies of them, but a serial, like a TV show, a series, is the best format mm-hmm. to get their stories right, because you can build things and you can take the time that's needed to do it. And I know you said, you know, I know you, you said you were, you know, feeling, you know, good about the sort of the pace of the season. And I overall do too, but I do, my one regret is that I, as far as what they're doing, is I do wish Disney had been like, not just 10 episodes. I wish they, I felt like they're hedging their bets. I wish it was like 13, something, you know, just a little bit more room to let things breathe, certain things breathe a little bit more. Like, I do feel like episode 3 was amazing, but it was sort of like so bookended, so tightly bookended within those 30 minutes or whatever.
I felt that way about episode 1.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you could say that about, you know, 2, I think, is perfection, but so many of them are excellent. But if you had also been able to give that storyline another episode or episode and a half, I mean, half an episode, it could have been, you know, it could have resolved and not felt maybe quite as rushed. So I do feel like they didn't maybe have the confidence they should have in doing it. Or maybe they just want to do 10 at a time and that's just how they want to do it.
I think it's the nature of streaming that they're just never going to make that many episodes of a season, really, especially for a streaming network. Yes. I think the way they'll get around it, seeming like this show is a huge hit, obviously. Yeah. This is like the greatest press they've had in forever. Yeah. They're going to exploit it. I think the way that they're going to do spinoffs.
Okay.
And I that's what I think. I mean, I'm totally speculating, but I think that they'll say like, they'll now, and I think the easiest way to do it is like saying X Factor or Alpha Flight or X Force or something, and they'll do their own spin on it. But I think that's the way they're going to like get more animated X-Men content in this style in like a more voluminous way. How much they're going to interconnect it, I don't know, but I think like that's probably the thing they're going to do, because I don't think they're ever going to want to say like, you know what, season 2, 22 episodes. You know?
Oh, yeah. And I certainly wouldn't be insane enough to demand 22 like TV used to be.
I mean, that'd be fun.
It would be, but at the same time, like, again, if it was a little bit more, but I will say this too. I feel like, of course, you know, for the ramp up and getting the first season out took almost 3 years. It felt like, right. But I know they've already recorded or have been recording season 2.
Yeah. Season 3
is in production.
Yeah.
So what I really hope is that the turnaround time between seasons, now that they've got this out of the way and they know it's a huge hit, I feel like my big hope is that now that they'll, the subsequent seasons, we won't have nearly as long of a wait.
Well, we'll see. You know, it's probably going to be another year. You know, we'll be back.
I would expect another year, but not 2 years, not 2.5 or 3.
Oh, yeah. I see what you're saying. all right. So Lalandra's advisor, Araki, he is like letting the Empress know that, like, listen, the people aren't interested in this marriage. Like, you're messing with people want stability because we're at war. And then Deathbird flies in and is like, I'm not going to sugarcoat this. Your marriage to Professor X is bullshit. He was born on the wrong side of the stars. I like that line.
That was great. Was that when she said the Milky Way?
She's getting to that. Yeah. Then she warns that a union with she warns that a union with a Terran would bind the Shi'ar into an alliance with an inferior planet, which she hasn't. I mean, the X-Men doesn't exist in the continuity of the MCU, but Earth as an inferior planet in the Marvel universe is not true. It's probably like the Alpha planet secretly, but that's besides the point. Earth, the home of, you know, like the fucking people that defeat Galactus on a regular basis.
Right. Good point.
She also reveals that the Shi'ar homeworld is a place called Chandelier, which is a detail I would never have remembered. And then here she gives like the line that like made me smile from ear to ear that you just alluded to. Xavier would see his Milky Way ghetto become our new throne world. I was thrilled to see this line take over social media all day. This was like the most hilarious, one of the greatest lines ever in the history of anything Marvel has ever done.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And I mean, I do remember too, like, correct me if I'm wrong, like the Shi'ar Empire is not in the Milky Way.
Oh no, I think it's like way, way, way further away.
It's not Andromeda, right? The real life Andromeda galaxy.
No, I forget the specifics, but my understanding is that it is very much very far away. Yeah, like a galaxy far away, right?
In the other direction of the Star Wars universe.
Opposite direction.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't a hilarious line. The Milky Way ghetto.
Yep.
Which honestly, I just saw like a video on YouTube. You know those Kazerkazat YouTube educational videos? Is this ring any bell to you?
I don't know if I know it by name, but I may have seen it.
They do these like animated videos about astronomy and like weird like cosmic facts about the universe. And they had one yesterday or the day before talking about how the reason we may have never seen aliens, even though there's probably thousands of civilizations in our galaxy alone, is that Earth might be on a weird galactic island just surrounded by too much like cosmic space junk that's like not easy for civilizations to like get around to. Because they say that like for traveling through space is so difficult that like you would need lots of like jump points to habitable places to like refuel or to rebuild or something on your insanely long space journey. And that Earth might just be the place where there's no like good like connecting planets to like hop to along the way, and that's why we've just never seen anyone. So we're just not in the interstellar route of like all the action.
I never actually heard that particular response to the Fermi paradox, but I've always been into that question of like, with billions and trillions of planets, how can there and star systems, how could it possibly be true that we're the only one with intelligent life? Well, yeah, but one of the answers here is that the other ones are just too far away. But this one's interesting because it's presupposing that other ones may be closer enough to each other, but just far too far from us specifically. So that's
right. Yeah. And then going back to this fictional world from Deathbird's opinion, Milky Way is a piece of shit galaxy.
So not just our solar system, but all the other.
Yeah.
Solar
systems Milky Way in general is just like a real waste of time. And she like invokes this like stupid right. I forget what it's called. Oh, the right of M. Dasha. Where she's like, he has to we have to erase his mind of everything that happened to him before he moved to the Shi'ar. And like Lalander considers this as like, yeah, maybe he should.
Seems fair.
At first she's like, oh, it's not going to be easy for him because he's like an incredible telepath. Like, I'm not just going to be able to like wipe his mind clean. She's trying to get Professor X out of it, but she's also like outright dismissing it, which again, like the red flags between Lalander and Professor X here are just way too numerous.
Yeah. I mean, and what was funny to me too, is I was kind of like, Lalander's a telepath. I did not remember that or I guess I'd never thought about it in those terms, but of course she was reaching out to him mentally way back in the Phoenix Saga. So of course she must be, but I guess I had just never thought about it like that. But you know, and at the same time, it sucks for Professor X, but you know, she is an empress and not like in any empress that we're or emperor kind of concept that we've ever understood on Earth, in the sense that she's not the empress of a country or a world, but like so many worlds.
She's and Emperor so, like, Palpatine.
Right. Well, hopefully not as nasty, but maybe. But right. The idea that she's, I get it in the sense that she's got a heavy heart about her responsibilities, and like she wants to have it all. And she's also, people can't always have it all, right?
She's also truly alien.
Yes.
I think there's like a lot of stuff the Professor X has to face here of like, maybe they have like a similar enough biology where they can, you know, have sex and enjoy each other's like intimacy or something. But like her world is too weird and it's not human enough. And like, I mean, it all culminates with him like having to do this huge like teaching scene of them and like teach them about ethics and stuff. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
We see Professor X, he's like weirdly considering all this. I guess he's, you know, he's really in love with Lalander and that's why. But it seems a little out of character. I think he would be immediately repulsed by this idea. I think he would think it's barbaric. Like if I was writing Professor X, I wouldn't assume that he would even like entertain this for a second for his mind to be violated in this way. He like sort of debates like the philosophy of this with Gladiator. They have a cool scene in front of these like statues of the Shi'ar gods. And we get some like more backstory of like the Shi'ar find art obscene and devious or something.
Yeah, that was cute. That was curious. I'd never heard that before in the show or the comics. And I actually was even interested, I'm sure it's been in the comics at some point, but back in the like original Phoenix Saga stuff, like in Dark Phoenix, I've heard of the Shara in Kithri as like an exclamation that they would say, like, oh my god, you know, like Lalander says it when she sees Jean turning back into Dark Phoenix on the moon during the battle, but I was always like, well, it's just something they say.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really cool to learn the, like what it actually, what it's referring to.
Yeah.
I like that scene a lot today. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was cool. I enjoyed that.
I just like the Shi'ar. Yeah. These weird bird people, they look cool. it's definitely a really awesome, like just little sci-fi empire that Claremont and, I don't know, like John Byrne or something, just like pulled out of their asses. And Lilandra, you know, she wants Professor X. She probably is like leaning towards wanting him to go through with this, which is crazy. Anyway, back to Earth. Forge and Storm have to go to Snowsnake Tower. Say that five times fast. That's where the cactus is going to be. It's like a mountain in the desert. It's filled with old Civil War weapons, which is kind of cool. And then there's a discussion about like Storm is like wondering why Forge's people like tried to help people that colonized the area and, you know, ended up fucking them over. And he's like, well, you know, he says like the greatest weapon of the colonists was not their guns or their blankets. It was their white lies. And before they could like dive into that interesting little bit of cultural commentary, like they're, like there's some immediate drama, like
I think he just faints. He gets too weak in that moment. Right, so that was interesting that they were really getting somewhere, but he just, they sort of, I think they're leaving it to the audience to
fill in the rest.
Yeah.
But they want to like go into like Forge, like, explain the entire like injustice history done to Native Americans in this brief cartoon. But right. You get the idea. And then you like get the idea of like this cave that Storm is going to have to crawl through. It's like extra small, like beyond the cave they're already in. Cut back to Xavier. He agrees to go through with this rite of passage, I guess.
And he goes through almost all of it.
And then like they challenge him specifically. It's like, all right, you're going to forget everything. You forgot about Earth. He's like, all right. He's like, and including the X-Men? And he's like, wait a second.
That's where he stops. And so I think, he was ready to, I think he doesn't really care that much about, he's willing to let go of so much, but not the X-Men, which again, that makes sense to me, but it's going to be a problem.
Big problem. Deathbird comes marching in. She accuses Xavier of like, oh, listen, he doesn't want to fucking do this. And she's like, and she has some really racist shit to say too. She's like, no one wants Shi'ar blood mixed with that of simians.
Yes.
And especially one who's like inferior freak fluids.
That was quite a quote as well. That stood out as.
And then you get a Shi'ar council member like joining the conversation, agreeing with her.
Yeah. And they're not even a regular human. He's a lower caste, a mutant.
Which kind of doesn't make sense because you think the Shi'ar would understand, like, first of all, like the mutants are more powerful than the humans. And especially
a regular human couldn't have stopped Deken and the Emperor and Crystal, but Xavier and his team could. And so it's a little,
I think it's like
myopic, that they didn't recognize that.
I don't think it's that they even believe it. I think the council member saying that politically.
Yeah.
They're looking for any kind of excuse to like reject this union between Lilandra and Xavier. Yeah. It's an incredibly fascinating scene. It rules. It like just the idea of like seeing space racism is a lot of fun. Like not like racism is fun, but space racism is like interesting. I mean, the point is the X-Men are fun. Like that's like what's cool about the X-Men is like taking like these ideas and just like keep like changing the setting and making it as wild as possible. And then, you know, Lilandra is like, she's ready to go with her war with her sister right here. She accuses her of going mad. She orders Gladiator to attack her troops. And Gladiator kind of like he punches her, which looks quite painful.
My daughters, when we watched it, they were like, oh, when Gladiator slammed Deathbird that punch, they felt it.
Right. And then we know that Gladiator essentially has the powers of Superman. So he's like ultra powered. He ends up, I mean, he basically kills her troops. Like he knocks them into like some bottomless pit. Charles is attacked in his legs. He's sort of like kneecapped in a way. But then like Xavier stops the violence. He, you know, when everything is devolving to chaos, he uses his, he remembers that he's got like incredible power. So he says to himself, he's like, oh, I've forgotten. I'm actually super awesome here. And he puts all the,
go on. I don't know how he just remembered it then. To me, so much of the episode, I was like, you can take over Deathbird's mind. And make her forget about all of her, you know, complaints. Like you can do all this if you want to. Now, of course, he's got his principles.
Yeah, but Lilandra also has his mental powers too.
Yeah, that's true. So it was very interesting.
They have the ethics of like not using their power, or maybe the Shi'ar, you know, psychics they're trained to get. Who knows? But
yeah.
He does take this opportunity to finally. He takes them all to the astral plane, and he takes on the role of school teacher, which this is like greatest, I guess, you know, his greatest like life's profession or something.
Yeah.
Cut back to Storm. She's digging through the cave. She's got like a flashlight in her mouth. It's very physically challenging for her. She sees where the cactus is. She kind of has to like climb up with her arms in a very difficult way to get this cactus. All the while, the adversary is like in her mind, like feeding off her fear and self-loathing and taunting her. But Storm has like incredible mental resiliency and determination, and she, you know, she can overcome the adversary's taunting. And now this is where I'm confused. So now this is like the great scene in the episode where Storm gets her powers back. I've seen a lot of people's interpretations today say that she never lost her powers. It was all a mental block that she just had to like overcome all the stuff like emotionally inside of her to regain her power. The way I read it when I saw the episode this morning is that Forge's treatment to her worked.
Yes, it just was delayed. Yes, you got it. And I had forgotten she went in that Forge built chamber until my second rewatch tonight. That's when I went back and watched the second part of, you know, when I watched part one of Life Death from 2 weeks ago. I had forgotten that she had tried that chamber and it seemingly didn't work. But what we know about Forge, as you were pointing out, that he's awesome as a character.
Yeah,
the stuff he makes works.
Yeah, he's not going to fuck up.
They were both really confused in part one why it didn't work. But you know what? The first time I watched today's episode, I was like, how can this possibly be true that she gets her powers back? But of course, that's the real explanation. You nailed it.
I mean, it might be a combination.
That's the thing. So it did work, but she tried to use her powers and it wasn't working.
Yeah.
But it's both. Once again, like, it worked, but she didn't believe it worked. She was so like down on herself, I think, and so despairing that she had that mental block in herself. So she had to do both. She had to use the Forge thing, but then she had to get over the mental part of it. And that's why it took that second watch to put it together. But obviously you got it too. And that's the coolest answer anyway.
Yeah. And I think the writing leads you to believe that you could take what you want from the writing. You could think that Storm overcame it all by yourself, or you could think of some combination of Forge, and if you're paying attention, you know, like because it is kind of easy to forget, because the show is literally telling you in that episode that it didn't work, but it probably did. But either way, it's really good writing. Storm gets her powers back, and then we're treated to one of the greatest animation sequences in the history of the X-Men cartoons ever.
Yeah,
where Storm goes flying like up into outer space, creates a new costume for herself. Is like flying around with horses posing in the sky. I mean, like, everyone's seen it at this point. I'm not doing it justice in the slightest, but I was so delighted with this sequence. I can't wait for Sonya to see it, by the way. She doesn't have access to the internet where she is right now, so she hasn't seen it, but like, she's going to be delighted to no end too. What did you make of this whole sequence?
Yeah.
One of the greatest moments in X-Men history. I would say so.
Yeah. It's one of the greatest moments in X-Men history.
Right.
Visually, and everything, you know, the music, just the way it was handled, you know, what it kind of reminded me of. Did you ever watch The Neverending Story?
Yeah.
And, you know, it has this totally bleak seeming, you know, result of the nothing destroying everything. And then all of a sudden things work out. And then he's riding Falcor and the music comes in and just like flying over everything and everything's great again. It felt like that scene, because it's one of the happiest like scenes of any movie, I think, and that this scene was really, to me, reminded me of that a little bit, like not while I was watching it, but after the fact. But what I have to say for me too about this scene is much like I was saying about Nightcrawler earlier.
Yeah, I was going to say Nightcrawler. Yeah.
Well, my biggest difference between being a kid watching the X-Men animated series in the 90s and the adult who has read the Claremont run is that when I was a kid, I loved all the X-Men except for Storm. I thought that Storm was really powerful and impressive and a good person and a good character in the sense of, like, you know, you'd always want to be on her side and have her have your back. But she was so stiff and wooden. And to me, like, and she had to announce every power that she did. And even though she's done that a little bit in the first couple episodes of this season, it wasn't as formal to me. It was a little more, you know, there was a little bit more, you know, it felt a little bit more natural. But when I went back then and read the Claremont run, I was like, oh, wait, Storm's actually one of the greatest characters ever written. She's absolutely amazing. And what I associate, though, with the version of Storm that I do love, that I came to love, is this costume, because this is her original Claremont run costume. And yeah, it's a little skimpy. It's a little old fashioned in that sense, like, you know, a lot of skin showing. So, well, no, I get it. But I guess what I mean is she's also had some good costumes, I think, and that I've seen online.
I mean, the silver one is recent great. Runs.
Yeah, but all I know is, for me, the Jim Lee one, I said it on the Facebook group in the comment today. It's like, to me, it always was just the only bad Jim Lee costume.
You don't like the silver one. Okay.
I don't like the Jim Lee one. To me, it's the equivalent of a 90s business pantsuit. Really, when you compare it to all the other costumes of all the other X-Men, like of the Jim Lee group, like, I just, for me, I've never liked
shoulder
it.
Shoulder pads and.
Yeah, all of that. And so for like to see Storm in that. Costume. Yeah, but
Storm. My only defense of the silver suit is Storm as a character is so beautiful as a woman that it's like she pulls off any kind of like weird fashion. Because I think you're right. I think on like any regular like woman, that costume would look weird and ugly. But I think like Storm is just a supermodel essentially, like all the characters are, male and female. But like you know, it's like she could pull it off. But I'm with you in the sense that this costume though, the original. Giant size X-Men costume is the best Storm costume. It's the coolest. It's the sexiest. And seeing her fly around in it, like at the height of her power, posing for the camera, it was so great. It was so thrilling and fun. And it also just like, again, like I hate to bring it back to this point, but it just dunks on the movies in a way that like the movies like famously have been very
so
like,
bad for Storm.
Yeah,
so that, her and Cyclops. Like, do you
realize what? Right. Yeah, it's like, do you realize what kind of character you have here? Like one of the greatest female characters in all of superhero comics, and you've just sidelined her as like a boring kind of quiet, almost like, you know, she has a few sequences here and there, but they never really like explore the full extent. And of course, in the death of her character, of the whole thing, it's like. This one sequence alone is just—it's just like so good.
It was great. And what's funny is, you know, like it was a little funny though to me because, like, we know from episode one of X-Men animated series that she can, you know, remake her costume or make, you know, do that
and,
kind of
and
thing.
And that's
we know
in the comics too, frankly.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But the hair was a little interesting in this episode. I love it. It's great to see her with the full head again of hair, but it was pretty funny that costume I buy. Hair was a little surprising,
that
but
was
hey,
a bit magical
whatever it
realism.
Takes. Yeah. Yeah. Whatever it takes. Maybe the adversary gave up and gave her as a gift.
I mean, I chalk it up to an artistic flourish of the show. Yes. Like they've been doing a few, they've had moments here and there of just kind of saying, we're doing this like weird thing. Just accept it because it's awesome. And it has not rubbed against me in any way that is like caused me to pause or say I'm not having a good time with this. Like I'm having a good time with all their choices they've made up to including this like Storm's hair magically regrowing in her head.
To be totally clear, it's not a complaint. It's literally like this is a little bit crazy.
Oh, yeah, I noticed
it
too.
And also I love it.
yeah, everyone noticed it. Like it's not that people did it, it's just you just accept it and it's a lot of fun. So what happens next? Storm, like, I mean, I also love her glowing eyeballs. She looks so ethereal and like strange and like freakish, like in a way that's awesome.
Yeah,
Forge is saved. And she's like, she has some really good dialogue where she's talking about how she overcame all this. She says, fears and shame, things we bury within us, hide from loved ones, even as they poison our hearts until we finally heal our adversary by embracing it. I mean, that is like true, like good, like new age, like self-healing philosophical stuff that, is like fun to see in an X-Men cartoon.
Yeah.
Storm is like always like a good font of wisdom in the show.
Yes.
A great role model, I'm sure, for kids as well. And Forge, he suggests they go to a tropical island. He's like, we could just fly to one, which is true. She could just lift him up.
Yeah.
She just go to Maui if they want to without having to get on a plane or anything and have a good time. But then unfortunately they turn on the television and they see what happened at Genosha. We get some light exposition from the newscaster. Trish Tilby, is that her name?
Yes.
That's a character from the comic. I don't remember this character from the comics.
She was a much bigger deal in X, like the original X Factor. She was became Beast's girlfriend. Mm. I think it started when he didn't have fur. There was a period where his fur went away for a little bit, but then he came back.
I posted on Facebook, I just recollected the issue of X Factor where Warren Worthington becomes Archangel for the first time.
Right. And from the X-Factor part of Follow the Mutants. So that's a good parallel to the,
and I had read that run of comics a long time ago too. I got like a big omnibus. I had just forgotten so much about it. Those comics aren't so good.
Yeah.
Although I do love that one issue. I also got the first Gambit appearance ever. I splurged.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is, I haven't read it yet. I mean, I've read it like way long ago, like digitally online, you know, like when I had like a disc of all the X-Men comics, but I don't remember it being like such a great comic too, but I don't know. I wanted to collect something meaningful in comic book form for real from the X-Men. And this is like the most affordable option. It was still over $100, but.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because the interior art, because the cover is Kubert, and then the interior art is somebody else. But, but of course it's a very important and memorable issue. I splurged like last year or the year before and got Uncanny X-Men 135, which is the Dark Phoenix, like official Dark Phoenix episode where issue where it's the green background and she's like huge and like crushing the X-Men
logo. Yeah.
Cause I had looked it up and even though it says it's from July of the year that it came out, you know, the comic dates are always like 3 months ahead, like 3 months later than they actually came out. So I learned that it came out in the week on April 15th of that year. And that's the week I was born. So it's literally like my, some people have their, you know, like their star sign from the
Now I want to get the comic from, I need to get my 1984 comic of it. I got to find out what that one was.
Yeah. So if you research it and you find the one that's 3 months ahead of your actual birth month, then that's the one to get. Because like for me, it said July, but it really came out in April.
Right.
So
that's I'd want the one that says my month though. I wouldn't care about.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
Yeah. Just say show February 84 or whatever.
There you go.
I said it on the podcast a few years ago too, where it's like I got the vague idea of like I want to spend big on an X-Men comic, and I had no idea what they were going for these days. And I was like, you know, if I can get like the first Wolverine appearance for like under $1,000, like maybe I'll do it. And then I immediately looked it up. It's like the cheapest, rattiest one was like $75,000.
What the fuck?
And I remember being a kid at my local comic store seeing that comic for sale for like maybe like $200 at most. Like it couldn't have been that much money. Because I feel like they must have made a million of them too. Like, cause that was like, you know, those comics are not in short supply. It's not like talking about like golden age era Superman where they're just all lost to time. Like people were collecting comics from the 70s. But like the idea that like that now it's like $75,000 for like, I just couldn't believe it. I was like, okay, well, and then I just ended up getting like the reproduction version. All right. Anyway, let's go on here. We're near the end. Yeah. Storm is very upset learning about Genosha. We also learned that mutants are not allowed to return to the home country. So the political situation for mutants is getting quite screwed up as well. It's pretty sad. And they're definitely building to some, and we're going to have to speculate at the end of this episode of like what this whole season is leading to. Back to Xavier. He's like in an astral classroom. It's kind of funny. He's like giving them, he's in full control. Like Deathbird tries acting out as he's trying to give a lecture on like peace and tolerance and coexistence. He has a line, coexistence is messy, which is pretty good. And but he like shoves an astral apple in Deathbird's mouth so she doesn't talk.
I really like this scene. I actually have to say, like, much like the Storm, it's not nearly on a par, but much like the Storm scene was one of her best scenes ever in any scene ever, this Xavier scene to me was one of Xavier's best scenes. I actually really enjoyed it. Not least of which, because it was funny. Like when Gladiator first like has an outburst, and when it starts, he's like, "You have to raise your hand, Gladiator, if you want to talk." and my girls who were in elementary school laughed out loud when he did that to him.
That's cute.
And like, and then and exactly the apple scene, and he said the word. He said demerits.
So
he brought out the demerits.
They're writing him more like they're writing more like the Claremont Xavier than the X-Men TAS Xavier. Which is interesting. Yeah. He's got a little bit more like character to him in this. Yeah. Like this is a version of Xavier I could see. Like, you know, Xavier in the Claremont comics had a lot of weird moments where he's outright like being such a bitch to Cyclops and
just
disrespectful. And then of course you don't even want to go back to the Stan Lee era where it's like he's like secretly crushing on Jean Grey. But like I can almost feel like with this version of Xavier that they're introducing, they could do some like weirder character stuff with him. I feel like that's on the table. Like, cause in the original cartoon, he's like a heroic, wise man that doesn't have much humor to him. You know, he's kind of like,
But he's also not the like sort of, you know, people online just like hate Professor X these days always because they're like, he's such an evil bastard. It's like, well, okay, maybe the writers did a lot of nasty stuff with him the last 20, 30
years. They got bored. They had to come up with different
ideas. Yeah. But, you know, the Professor X from the 90s and earlier,
yeah,
he had some weirdness to him, but he wasn't this like scheming bastard. He was just, it's a guy trying to do his best and failing.
Yeah, he was in the mold of like a civil rights leader.
Yep.
All right. So, I mean, and he has some like crazy lines where he calls the Shi'ar Empire a snake oil racket, which is quite.
I don't know if they would understand the reference when he said that. I was like, are they going to know what that means?
Right. And then like he's, you know, and then he just is giving his message that he had on Earth too, where he says like might makes right is not smart. That's like a stupid way to run a civilization. It is kind of weird. Like
the rhyme that sells the lie. That was a good line.
Yeah, that was a good line too. Yeah. And then, like I said, he says coexistence is messy. That was a good line. But then like, I guess because he's using his powers for the first time in a long time, he gets some kind of like psychic alarm that something is wrong on Earth. And he gets these visions like Gambit appears for him as this large, like, giant, and then he like flashes and turns to a skeleton, which, you know, signals to Professor X that he's dead. And this immediately convinces the professor that he has to go to Earth immediately. You know, and Landra's like, you've almost convinced the council, like, we're not gonna have to wipe your mind for us to get married. But no, the bond deeper than love is broken, and Professor X says, you know, I have to return to my X-Men.
Yep, back to the Milky Way ghetto he goes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I'm going to just be a little critical here. Of all the characters who could have died that make him return to Earth, Gambit being the one.
Well, yeah.
I'm not saying that like he doesn't love Gambit any less than any of the other characters, but it's
maybe little bit
less. He's like, he was almost ready to get his mind erased.
Yeah,
for this woman to stay, to live in this whole new life. But then when he hears when like Gambit is dead, like, no, I got to go back home. Like, actually, like,
yeah, not Remy. I feel like it was, you know, mostly symbolic, though, because it was kind of his in to then, because of Gambit dying, it was his into learning about the greater tragedy.
There's a Holocaust in Genosha. Yeah.
Right. So I feel like it was more symbolic because, yeah, I absolutely see your point. He's never been like, you know, he's never been this a Cyclops style surrogate
like
son.
Me and Gambit, like, we had the best times. Like, he was my best friend, Professor X and Gambit, the best times.
They basically have no real relationship, not really.
And yeah, so, they never explored. Yeah,
yeah.
But they do show, you know, they did show a lot of Gambit talking about how much he respected Professor X and did not like Magneto in the season.
Sure,
like, that was a big part. Like, they did lay the groundwork for that. And also, he does talk about like missing Magneto too, his like best friend, which was interesting as well. But you're right, like his real—it's not so much Gambit being dead, which is a tragedy to him. It's the idea of Genosha being destroyed in a horrible way.
Well, and what that moment though in the astral plane did to me seem to symbolize, but I can be wrong, is that Gambit's dead for real, but Magneto maybe is not. If Magneto was dead for real, it would have been Magneto and not Gambit.
Period. And I also don't think Gambit is dead for real. I think that is.
Well, maybe not.
Do you think they're going to kill Gambit for? They're not going to keep him dead. That's too.
We just don't know. I think it's certainly possible, but I agree. I mean, it's not a definite, especially when time travel is a potential situation. I mean, with Cable.
Alluding to the Age of Apocalypse in the opening credits too, which was also about altering the future with the young Professor X. Like,
right.
It's just too much. Where again, I don't know if it's going to happen at the end of season one, though. I suspect it will. That Gambit will be revived. It could be a season two thing where. It's like they do some like Apocalypse stuff and Mr. Sinister stuff with Gambit, which I know is sort of part of his insane comic lore and history, which is quite overcomplicated in my opinion. Right. So they might do that. They might like, you know, they bring him back like morph and like in some like weird zombified way until he like regains his sanity.
Yes. Yeah. It's all possible. And speaking of Sinister.
Yeah. Yeah. So the episode closes with, we see that like, Trask was the one who had given Mr. Sinister his DNA so he could access Master Mold. Sinister was the one that masterminded the attack on Genosha. He says that the beginning of a prologue has now passed. And, you know, he's alluding to the story has just begun. And Trask only needs to place his faith in Sinister and everything's going to work out fine. For who, I don't know exactly, but...
Well, that's the big thing. I mean, obviously, all the pre-release stuff of the season, before the season came out, they had gone on record, the writers, as saying Mr. Sinister is the big bad of the show for this season. I had seen that reported many times. It seemed like that he had sort of a one-shot episode in episode three and then vanished. So, no, here he is. He was behind Genosha, but, like, my big question is, why? I know that maybe it's a variation on the Mutant Massacre when he intentionally had the Marauders in the comics go murder all the Morlocks because he wanted to purify the mutant race a little bit. But even the explanation they eventually gave for that was a little unclear about what he really gained from that.
Yeah.
It seems to me like that's the only best thing I'm grasping at right now is like he wanted to sort of wipe clean a bunch of mutants so that he can, I don't know, like have a purer mutant race to go forward. But there's a lot still to be explained because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
It reminds me of in Days of Future Past, the movie, or no, not Days of Future Past, the one before that, X-Men Begins, right? First Class.
Oh, First Class, right.
Shaw wants to destroy the world to rule it in a way. It's like maybe Sinister thinks, like, I got to destroy this mutant island, and then, like, I'm only going to rule the survivors, and I'm going to be able to, like, conquer it my own way and do whatever I want. And this, similar to what he did in the Savage Land. What do you think of Mr. Sinister? Do you like this character in general?
I do like the character, but I feel like they're... In the wrong writer's hands, he could be done very badly and has been done very badly. It takes a lot to make him
come across well, I think.
Right. I mean,
I've enjoyed him in the cartoons.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know about the comics. Yeah. I don't know if I loved him in the comic books.
Right. I've seen him in ways that I think are fantastic, in ways that are just like, oh, boy. So, you know, it really depends on who's writing him. And, well, you know, the jury's out for the rest of the season, what they do and what kind of motivation or reasons they give him for this. But we'll see. I'm certainly open to it. And the voice actor is always fun to listen to.
Yeah, they got the original voice actor guy back, who I love. He has like a really sassy take on him. I know they have plans. They want to do Mr. Sinister in the live action X-Men, wherever they bring it back. You know, I don't know. Like, I think Mr. Sinister is a great cartoon character again, like, because he's just like a weird vampire monster man with a strange costume. I don't know how that translates to live action. But
they have to rein him in big time in live action to have him be anything other than laughable. It's true. You know, I don't agree with people that are like, you know, what do you prefer, yellow spandex? That whole attitude of like, you know, you can't translate comics to screen in a faithful way, because we know that's not true anymore. But there still are some things that you got to find a way to attenuate it a little bit, or it's going to just, on its face, will just look too ridiculous. And Mr. Sinister...
Well, first of all, his name is ridiculous. He's like fully in line with Dr. Doom of being a name that is so stupid for live action that it's like it's complicated to try to sell it in a way that is just not stupid. But, I mean, I don't mind. I mean, they're probably just going to stick with it. It's fine. But I love the story of Mr. Sinister in the sense of like him being an evil mutant geneticist who is like a creepy, like almost like a Nazi-esque doctor who wants to do experiments on people, and he has like no sympathy or no like concern for like the people he victimizes in the way he experiments. I think that is like a scary character.
Yeah.
And very cool in the X-Men universe. It's just like the whole presentation of him, and it's also like weird undefined power set, which is like quite strange.
Yeah. Oh, you know, what's interesting to me is that in season five, the badly animated last half of season five, when they have his episode of his backstory of Descent, it was very cool and well done. Mm-hmm. What was interesting to me, though, is that there was no appearance of Apocalypse there, because in the comics in the 90s, when they did his when they did his limited series of Mr. Sinister's origin there first, before that episode from season five was done, Apocalypse is the one who changed him from being a guy to being a mutant, or whatever he is, more than a guy. Yeah. And so, and what I liked about that miniseries is it eventually all linked back to tying together the idea that Sinister created Madeline Pryor as the broodmare, so to speak, with Cyclops to create Cable, with the idea in mind that Cable would be his you know, sort of, you know, super mutant slave, super mutant servant that would then defeat Apocalypse for him. So he would have free reign without having this debt to Apocalypse anymore. I loved kind of the way it all tied together. And it also worked great because an Apocalypse is the one who infects the baby with the, unlike the show this season, Apocalypse in the comics is the one who infects the baby with the technovirus.
Right. Yeah.
Causing Cable to get sent to the future, thus also causing the whole thing with Strife.
Right. So
it all tied together really in a cool way. And the motivation for Cable's existence was Mr. Sinister wanting to have an ace in the hole to defeat Apocalypse from encroaching on him. But that's not necessarily what they're going to do here. Who knows? But I still, I do like that.
I think they're going to take a lot of those elements and I think they're going to clip them in a way that's legible.
And
I think it'll be nice. And I think, and also in general, Mr. Sinister in the cartoon works great. I have no problems with him. I love him in the show. No issues. I do get a little wary about him transferring to live action. I mean, apparently John Hamm filmed shit as Mr. Sinister for, I don't know, the Gambit movie or
I heard that
some movie that was never made, or maybe for New Mutants, maybe.
What it was. It was the New Mutants one. Yeah.
He supposedly filmed stuff as Mr. Sinister, and he's a huge comic fan and was very excited to finally get a part in the MCU or some, whatever the Fox version of it anyway. But so.
And then they cut it.
All right. I know. I wonder what that looks like. I don't know. Well, I guess the time will tell on Mr. Sinister. All right, Brian, before we go though, tell me about do you have any like burning hot predictions for this supposed epic three part? We're going to episode 7, which I think is going to be about Cable or something, but then there's going to be a 3-part conclusion, right? 3 episodes to end it. Do you have, is anything bubbling for you as a grand theory? I mean, I got nothing yet. I have no idea.
I'm on the same page as you. It's so tough, honestly, because the one thing it can say about this season, if nothing else, there's a lot of great things to say about it, but are true. One thing you can absolutely say is you really can't predict what exactly they're going to do next. Like things, the idea that they were going to, that they did the Madeline Pryor thing again, to me was like, what? They're doing Inferno in a single episode? You know, like you really just don't know, you know, aside from episode titles like Life, Death, that kind of gave things a little away. They've taken such an approach that you really can't tell what's going to happen next because of their powers of masterful, like we've been talking about all episode now, the remixing of so many X-Men stories, things could go in so many different directions, honestly.
Yeah, and it's also seems like to me it's obvious that Gambit's going to come back to life, and the laziest way to do it would be through time travel. But it almost seems like they're aware like that's too simple. Like, I don't think it's going to be a real, because, and first of all, they did that in the original cartoon anyway, in a couple of different episodes where they had like a fake ending and then they go back in time and like Time Fugitives, right? Like they fix it. So I don't think they're going to repeat that where it's just going to be like Cable manages to get to the point in time he needs to get back to and he saves Genosha at the Hellfire Gala, whatever that was, right? Like, I don't think it's going to be. So I don't know either. I have like no idea really like where it's going to turn. I think it'll be a happy ending. I don't think they're going to end season 1 on a downer.
I agree. I've seen people saying things like, oh, the Genosha massacre, I thought that was going to be the finale. And I thought my reaction was like, wow, you thought that was going to be the finale? What a miserable, horrible end that would be to the season. The X-Men have got to have their tragedy, but they've got to also have triumph. And it's like, that would be way too like dark and unnecessarily cynical to end the season with something like that. I feel like, you know, I would expect episode 7 and 8 to up the ante, episode 9 to get really dark and desperate and, you know, dangerous, like the typical kind of plot, but it's typical because it works. And episode 10 to be a great victory of in one way or another, maybe a Pyrrhic victory and maybe with some extra, you know, some little hint at something bad for the next season at the end. But overall, to be a happy-ish ending, I hope.
We saw Cap Shield, which people think it just might be Morph or Mystique or something. You know, but the thought I had was it's a basic thought. It's like, oh, maybe they'll just do a huge crossover as part of the big finale where you see the Fantastic Four and Iron Man or something, and they all come to help the X-Men fight whoever needs to be fought, and they're gonna like animate their version of Endgame. Which I think that's in the car. I think they could do something like, but and that would be because they're probably like trying to like light up you know, the fan base in a way too, that gets people extremely excited and hyped, like, oh, I can't believe fucking Daredevil, you know, like was fighting with the Nightcrawler or something, you know, like this is like they'll do it. And the animation's really cool in the show, where I think they could just get away with the big cameo fest super team up, and you know, and also Spider-Man's on the table too, you know, and that would be kind of thrilling if they bring back you know, the 97 Spider-Man guy.
Oh, right. I mean, literally, it's nothing would surprise me. I mean, yeah, in the sense that I would believe anything could happen in those next few episodes. Everything would be, it will surprise me, but in a good way, in a way that it's like, oh, I didn't expect them to go that route or to bring in those characters or this character. So,
yeah. Brian, we're almost about done here. Do you have any more flaming hot X-Men takes about anything you need to get off your chest? This is yours.
Yeah, we've covered so much, and I really appreciate the time with it. But I will say, I am a dad. I've been looking forward to, ever since it was announced, to be able to watch these episodes with my kids. And what I had done for the first 4 weeks was watch it by myself first and then show it to them in the evening after I had sort of cleared it, embedded it. I was a little unsure about episode 3 with how creepy all the Inferno stuff was, but I eventually... My daughters insisted. They're like, oh, we want to see it because they love the first two so much. And I was like, all right, well, if you get too scared, let me know and we'll just stop it. It's okay. And I'll just tell you what happens and you move on to next week. My 5.5-year-old loved the Madeline Pryor episode and watched it like 12 times in a week because she was so into it and not scared at all. I was like, hey, great. So then the next week was Mojo and Life, Death, Part 1. I'm like, oh, this is all gravy. They can watch this night. That's easy. And so then last Wednesday, there was no school. It was a holiday. So we were all home in the morning and I was like, well, let's just watch this one without me watching it first. Episode 5. Remember it. And we will remember it because that was a big mistake.
Oh, they really? Like,
they were traumatized. That's totally different than.
Oh, wow.
Than,
you know, oh, man. They couldn't take it.
You know what? Gambit die and maybe Leech and the you know, they showed
that
like,
was really,
they,
yeah, the more
they showed Callisto lying on the ground with her like pupil like dilating and dying right there, like on camera. It was really a lot worse than I expected. So any parents out there, even when you think things are good, I still would recommend yourself first.
Wow.
don't watch it live with the kids because earlier today I went back and listened to part of our emergency bonus episode where the panel, me and some of the other fans.
Thank you for doing that, by the way.
Well, yeah, in 2021 it was great, and you had a part where you asked what concerns we might have, and one of the concerns that a few people raised was like, is X-Men 97 just going to still be like for kids, or are they going to recognize that their core audience has grown up and you could still make it appealing to maybe the whole family, but certainly have it elevated to a level that for a more mature level. And we know that the rating system is showing that it is for, what isn't it? TV 14. I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever
yeah,
it 14, is. It's not, you know, the equivalent of rated G.
Right. It's not Bluey.
Right. Exactly. And so I love it for that. I love that they did that. And I love that, again, with a little bit of parental guidance, my kids, even at young age, can watch it and enjoy it too. But I do love that it's more mature, of course, than the original series for a variety of reasons.
I think it's a cool show. I think you're a cool dad, and your daughter's cool by exposing them to it. I think that, you know, and the show famously in the original one too didn't talk down to its audience. You know,
right.
it was just, that's why I loved it as a kid, is that I felt like they're taking me seriously as an X-Men fan, as a young kid audience viewer. Like I mean, that was the revelation of the show, really. And that's really the thing that like bugs me the most when people like slag the original series. Oh, you can't watch it. It's not good. It's like, I don't think you really watched it. It's good. This show is building off of that show in so many ways. It's better, but that's really more of a byproduct of time more than the original show is better just because it was original.
You're absolutely right. It was very respectful of the audience's intelligence, even for kids, and I'll always appreciate a show that does that.
You know, Marvel cartoons before X-Men, it was like dopey Spider-Man and Amazing Friends, which I do kind of love, but that's in a very
For different reasons. Yeah. Exactly. You love it for a different reason.
It wasn't like Spider-Man and Amazing Friends did not like explore the death of Gwen Stacy arc or allude to any serialization of anything that was,
Yeah.
Although, you know, if they ever bring back the Spider-Man, this is the last thing I'll say is I'm sorry for wasting your time, but they got to do a Spider-Man and his Amazing Friends tribute episode of some kind, like make it like cool and new and like, you know, gritty in a way, you know what I mean? Not gritty, but like more appropriate to the style of like X-Men or Spider-Man, like have Iceman team up with Spider-Man and Firestar and introduce her along the way. That would be my secret fantasy.
Oh, definitely. They would. That's a no-brainer for sure.
Oh, I'm glad you're on board with that too. All right, Brian, thank you again so much for filling in for Sonia. Truly great job. I'm excited to keep communicating with you, with the rest of the audience. You know, down the road, we should do this again. And I just want to say good night, everybody.
Good night.